in all. Listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the May 20th edition of the show. Our starting line on the Sunny Side of Sports is African athletics. Top African distance runners make much of their money by competing in international races. But with big events canceled or postponed because of the coronavirus pandemic, this is impacting their income and training. Marta van der Wolf reports from the Dutch capital, Amsterdam.
Ethiopian runner Mimi Belete competes internationally for Bahrain and was training to participate in her third Olympics this summer. With training camps being shut down because of the coronavirus, Mimi is now training by herself on the outskirts of Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa.
Difficult because, you know, when you're training with group, it's much easier. And when you're training with group, you feel like powerful. In training alone, sometimes I feel like very weak, hopeless sometimes.
While Mimi is missing out on potential prize money and starting fees, she feels fortunate that Bahrain is paying her a salary. Michelle Boeting, a Dutch manager of more than 30 Kenyan athletes, says less prominent runners and those just starting out don't have that kind of cushion.
Most African countries don't have like a stipendium for their athletes, so the alternatives to make money, they really have to look outside the athletics. In East Africa, many athletes, and especially in Kenya, have like a small farm or they have small businesses that they have opened up, and some focus more on that now. But running-wise, there's very little you can do to make money.
The pandemic forced the postponement of top spring races like the Boston Marathon. The Olympics were due to take place in Tokyo in July and August, but that too was postponed. The cancellation of the races has Ethiopian runner-turned-coach Getane Tesema worried. He's a coach with a Dutch-based agency training top athletes such as Berhanu Legesse, who won the Tokyo Marathon twice. Getane is not only worried about the condition of his runners now that they train by themselves, but also about their financial future.
You can say there are three kinds of groups in this case. Athletes who won a lot of prize money. They don't have the problem at all. And athletes who went aboard and won some races. And certainly there are upcoming athletes. They don't have income at all. And that group, they are really hurting right now with income.
The Tokyo Summer Olympics are now scheduled for 2021 if the pandemic is brought under control. Mimi Belete had initially qualified to run for Bahrain, but now she is unsure if she has to compete in new races to confirm her spot on the Olympic team. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Amsterdam.
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
My name is Joshua Cheptegei of Uganda, a world champion, a Devil Commonwealth Games champion, a world cross country champion, a three-time world record holder of the 5K, 10K, and 15K. My message to the athletes all over the world and other people is that keep a distance and follow the guidelines given to you by your governments and the health ministries, because the COVID-19 is really a serious disease.
Serious realities indeed, Joshua. That's Joshua Cheptegei, Uganda's world champion runner. Elsewhere in African athletics, three-time world half marathon champion Jeffrey Kamwar of Kenya is optimistic he'll come back stronger when competition resumes after the coronavirus pandemic. Kenya's Daily Nation newspaper quotes the 27-year-old Kamwar saying, "I have been training alone at home after I bought a treadmill to help me in training. I thought the government might not allow anybody outside their homes, and I had to plan well." When he's not training on the treadmill, Kamwar reportedly has been training recently outside his house with marathon world record holder Eliud Kipchoge. Now let's go to Germany, where the Bundesliga recently became the first major European football league to resume play in the wake of the coronavirus crisis. The Bundesliga matches were played over the weekend under strict conditions. Most notably, they were held in empty stadiums. For reaction, Iron Mike Mbonier contacted a German football analyst and the CEO of Result Sports, Mario Leo.
Yeah, Bundesliga back in action. Yeah, it's been an interesting, different, new setup, obviously. Bundesliga was in lockdown since the March 13th, where the weekend games 13th, 14th, 15th were fully cancelled. After recovering from the first shock and obviously monitoring the situation, the Bundesliga and the DFL has worked a very thorough plan, a very thorough paper on hygienic quarantine and everything being considered. Obviously, this document was given to the health authorities. The health authorities have approved that process with the government, and that led to the government decision that the Bundesliga can resume matches. So it's been a big step for the Bundesliga, and it's been really great to see that the teams back in action. Obviously, with the Bundesliga back in action, that puts some pressure on La Liga and the Premier League and the Serie A, because obviously what we noticed on the weekend's match day is that the coverage of the Bundesliga had significant numbers in the UK, in Spain, in North America, in South America, because it was the only active league of the top 10 leagues around the world being able to play. And obviously that gives a unique window of opportunity around the world for the Bundesliga teams to gain new followers, to gain new communities around the world, and obviously that comes to a threat to the Premier League, to La Liga, and to Serie A, who are still sort of just starting to regain. And I think the clubs, they see that threat and obviously now do everything possible that the leagues in England and especially in Spain will resume very, very quickly.
What's the assessment of African players who played as the league resumed?
It's obviously a very different setup now, because 1 week, 7 days before the matches will take place, or are scheduled to kick off, the teams have to go in quarantine in a hotel or in a football school and basically be isolated from the families and friends. I think that's very challenging for some of the African players, because obviously their friendly environment, their trusted families and friends are not around them, but obviously they have their teammates, and I think they're very well integrated. And I could see that, yeah, the likes of Hakimi and so have done a great performance. I mean, Borussia Dortmund fine-tuned their match very well, and obviously the strength of Hakimi came out great, but also all the other players, they are a great talent, and they enrich the Bundesliga and the teams they play with absolutely to a maximum.
Do you think African players have bright prospects in the Bundesliga?
Yeah, I completely agree and completely see that the African talent here in the league, with the likes of Samaseko, Haidara, Hakimi, many others across, they are enriching the Bundesliga because their attitude, their style, their passion and dedication, their skill set is superb, and obviously follows the likes of Anthony Yeboah or JJ Okocha, who's brought the Bundesliga to an international greatness, and also obviously to a very strong African fellowship. I think what the Bundesliga now need to do is obviously be smarter in the rights management on the African continent. Obviously, with the season being now back in action and everything being in a positive way and the only big league playing, I think it's a big opportunity for the Bundesliga to shine across all the continents and have an exclusivity across the globe.
That's German football analyst Mario Leo, the CEO of Result Sports. And Mario spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Germany.
My name is Mario Leo. I'm the founder and chief executive of Result Sports. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Thank you for having me on the show.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, DC.
My Voice of America colleague, Adam Phillips, spoke with Laurent Dubois, author of The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. In his interview with Adam, Dubois said to understand the sport, you must also understand its African influence.
I say in the book, I think it's the most widely shared form of human culture, period. I mean, there are obviously music and religion, but this is a very specific game that is played all over the place, almost a universal language that almost anywhere on the planet, if you didn't speak any other language, you might find this as a kind of common ground.
Even though soccer is universally played, your book draws a lot on the work of the historian Peter Alleghi, who wrote a book called African Soccerscapes.
He really argues that the modern game of soccer, the way it's played globally, has really been shaped by African styles of play and African players over the years. Especially starting in the 50s and 60s, the way that Africans played really became a kind of global phenomenon.
What is the African style of play that you allude to? You say that they sort of made it their own.
It's hard to generalize about the whole continent, but there definitely is a strong premium on certain kinds of very creative, technically brilliant play. To dribble around other players, you know, to kick the ball in kind of extraordinary ways. That's valued by coaches and it's valued by fans, and it becomes kind of part of the style. But so there's a kind of symbiotic relationship between what the people want to see and then what players do. So it's not necessarily, you know, ingrained in the culture, but there are these kind of preferences that emerge over time and that people see, you know, certain kinds of play as particularly great play.
Your book also talks about African soccer culture and its interplay with African history and the history of colonialism as well. Tell me how those two go together.
The origins of the sport are definitely in colonialism, and it's brought to the continent by English missionaries, by English teachers, in the French colonies as well. And so part of it is there's always a kind of pleasure in beating the colonial rulers at their own game, right? But what also happens is that people find that in colonial societies, the soccer team becomes a really new, powerful way to articulate local belonging. Sometimes ethnic groups, you know, form their own soccer teams. There are a lot of teams that are founded in Cameroon and elsewhere that have a particular kind of identity as a location or a group, and they kind of then carry the pride of that group, right? And they can kind of compete either against white colonial teams or other African teams. And then once you get to the period of decolonization and independence, the two things that new African countries do is to join the United Nations and join FIFA and become part of the Federation of Football. Playing on the international scale, having teams on the international scale becomes a really important way for African countries to be on the global stage and sort of take pride in their presence there.
In Africa, the relationship between politics and sport didn't just end with decolonization. It also had a lot to do with sort of promoting a national pride.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in Senegal or a nation like Cameroon, which has also had a very storied career internationally, Ghana also, all these nations, I think the national soccer teams do become, you know, very potent symbols.
Tell me more about how national pride and culture played out in Senegal, for example.
In the book, I tell the story of a man known as Alou. His full name was Alassane Ndiaye, who is a school teacher and kind of intellectual in Senegal, who kind of by accident ended up becoming a commentator for radio matches and becoming this kind of great commentator in Senegal. And what he was able to do was he would take the kind of traditions of griot storytelling and kind of epic stories in West Africa and use those to kind of infuse the way he narrated a match. And as such, he was kind of teaching people to see in the game a kind of reflection of their broader, deeper culture and literature.
Of course, something that distinguishes African soccer overall from Western and American soccer is that in Africa, soccer teams often don't have the material resources and support that soccer players get at the highest levels in the United States and Europe.
It's true that all over the world, obviously, infrastructure helps. You know, when people have access to fields and those sorts of things, that makes a big difference. At the same time, you know, people can learn to play the game even in very modest conditions, as long as they have a ball and a place to play. And in some ways, growing up in places where it's hard to play, where the ground is rough, forces you to develop really great technique. And that can then develop, you know, really strong players as well. The point is that soccer fans all over the world, they want to win, of course, but they also like their teams to play a certain kind of game, to see a certain kind of spectacle. And they take pride when their players play a kind of what they consider to be a beautiful style. So it's not only about winning, it's also about kind of embodying certain kind of values that they want to see embodied on the pitch.
Is there a difference between sub-Saharan soccer and football and, say, you know, in the north where it's more Arab?
It's true that Egypt has a very deep, old history of soccer. They were actually one of the earliest nations to join FIFA, and there's different styles of play there. In West Africa, of course, the current situation is one in which, because a lot of the African professional leagues are kind of underfunded and don't have enough money, the aspiration of a lot of African players is to go play in Europe, and many of the best players do play in Europe. So you do have this kind of interesting situation, almost maybe a certain kind of neo-colonial relationship where the top of the African players are brought into Europe. And while they can make a lot of money there, there's a kind of inequality in terms of funding between African soccer and European soccer that recapitulates other kinds of relationships that are ongoing.
I know that the way people deal with referees, the teams and players' relationship to the rules might be different culturally between, say, the United States and some African countries. Do you agree with that? And if so, could you explain to me how that boils down in your view?
Well, a lot of the sports culture in the United States has a kind of real focus on fairness and, in fact, rationalizing the sport, which is why most of our sports use extensive video replay and kind of analysis, whereas soccer is starting to do that, but there's a lot of decisions that have to be made immediately by the referee, which means there's a lot of room for human error. And my argument in the book is that I think that actually contributes to the theatricality of the game, which is part of what contributes to its popularity. There's a lot of calls that could go one way or another, just depending on the referee and what they saw and exactly what you do. So there's a whole kind of arsenal that a soccer player has to have, which has to do with influencing the referee. And I love to watch that and see how they're doing it. The rule of thumb is that when a player does well, maybe dives and gets a foul, and you're rooting for that team, you always love it. When the other team does it, it's outrageous and you hate it, right? So there's a way in which, depending on what way it goes for you, you might have different ethics about it. But I also think what it does is it allows for you to really appreciate certain kinds of players who are able to figure out the whole situation, including what the referee is going to do, and kind of maximize their success in that situation using all the tools at their disposal.
And this is a little bit emblematic of political and social cultures in a lot of African countries, where there may be rules written down, but there's a certain amount of finesse that you need to have in order to negotiate your way through it.
I mean, again, people appreciate the sport because a lot of the ambiguities that you see in the sport are ambiguities you'll also experience in your real life, right? So the referee is not exactly an arbiter of justice fully. I mean, they're there to represent the rules, but obviously they can be manipulated, and every situation is a little different. The direct approach to the goal is almost never possible, right? It always has to be somewhat sinuous and moving around, and, you know, so things are never obvious, right? That's true, in life in a lot of African contexts, too. The way to get to your goal, right, is going to take a lot of twists and turns, a lot of negotiations, a lot of kind of one-on-one negotiations, as well as kind of being part of a collective. So the appreciation you have for someone who can figure out a way through this incredibly complicated network of people in their way, basically, which is the other team, you know, is something that I appreciate, because that's what people have to do in their daily lives, too.
That's Laurent Dubois, the author of The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. And he was talking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Dubois talked about the pleasure experienced by African football teams in beating their former colonial rulers at their own game. His comment brought back pleasurable memories for me of being in Seoul for the opening match of the 2002 World Cup. Senegal upset former colonial ruler France, the defending World Cup champion, 1-0 on a goal by Papa Booba Diop. VOA's Gwen Uden joins us now with a look at how a top American swimmer is coping with the coronavirus pandemic. Sporty greetings, Gwen.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. With the Tokyo Olympics set to begin in 2021, Olympians are now faced with the challenge of staying fit for another year and are forced to find creative alternatives on how to train during the coronavirus outbreak. American swimmer Caleb Dressel is a two-time Olympic gold medalist, 13 times world champion, and current world record holder in the men's 100-meter butterfly. And like thousands of athletes, he was focused on qualifying for a trip to Tokyo when news of the game's postponement broke. Dressel spoke to Reuters News last month from his home in the U.S. state of Florida about how he's had to adjust to the year-long delay, and he said he'll do whatever it takes to be ready, even making the switch from water to land.
If the swimming pools get shut down, then I guess I'm going to get really good at running. There are ways around it to just keep that heart rate up. but for the most part, we're all in the same boat. But it is tough. I mean, of course, I would like to have my normal routine, but I don't have that. So what are the next steps to take? If I have to train in my living room, if they completely shut everything down, I can't leave the house, then I'm training in the living room, you know? Like I said, it's a part of the puzzle. It's a part of the process. If I don't have something available, then we'll make do. So if I got to train in my living room, then I'll get ready.
Fortunately, Dressel is one of the few swimmers who has access to a pool, and he says he is still able to train and adhere to the practice of social distancing.
There is one pool open that's about 45 minutes away from me. And then I am fortunate enough to have my strength coach actually has all his equipment, all the needed equipment with the normal weight routine I'm on in his garage. So weights has been fine. My strength levels are fine, just maintaining the best I can. Don't want to fry myself at this moment, like I was saying, because the meet is so far along and kind of out of reach a little bit. But, you know, I have pool time Monday to Friday, 45 minutes away, only singles. But, you know, I'll drive further if I have to. So I don't know. Again, it's just with uncertainties. I don't know how long that pool is going to be open. It's a small group. I'm not breaking any of the rules that we have in place here. It's a very small group that's going up there to train. We sign waivers before we get in the water of we're symptom free. We haven't been out of the state, all this stuff. So I'm taking the right steps for sure. I don't want to put anyone in harm's way just so I can get to a pool in Florida. But it has been tough. I miss swimming.
Dressel's contract with the International Swimming League is keeping him afloat financially during the crisis. ISL will provide monthly funding to all its contracted athletes through to next year's rescheduled games. And Dressel says the financial support gives him peace of mind in a time of uncertainty.
I don't know when my next swimming is going to be. I don't know when I'm going to be back in the pool I normally train at. I don't know when campus is going to open up again. There's uncertainties for everybody. I'm not the only one in this boat. I don't want to play the victim here at any part. I still have a job. Worst thing is my Olympics got canceled. Okay. I wasn't even on the Olympic team. Okay. So really the worst thing for me was U.S. Olympic trials got canceled. Okay. I wasn't even guaranteed a spot going to Tokyo. So it's fine. Not even canceled. It got postponed. So, okay. My meet's a year later. That's the worst thing that happened to me. So to be able to have, through all this uncertainty, a meet that we know is going to happen, you know, financial gains that are in place already through Constantine and ISL, it's huge for everyone to have that fallback during a time like this and to have that support through ISL, which was so much fun last year. I mean, I enjoyed it. The new teammates I made, being a part of a whole new team that didn't exist before rather than a country, which is how typically all swimming competitions are set up, country versus country. So it's nice to have, you know, that unity, of course, within not just one country, but, you know, swimmers from all over the world to be able to fall back on that same plan that was put in place last year. And then to come up with that, whether it was plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, whatever from Constantine, and to have something in place that is for sure, is tremendous. It's huge for us, to have that support. It means so much because, you know, swimming is not the biggest sport in the world. I totally understand that. I don't really care, but to have someone who does care about us, it's massive.
ISL plans to get all its swimmers back in competition in late fall if the coronavirus is contained. Dressel competed last year in the ISL's inaugural season, but he says he hasn't yet committed to making a return.
There's so much uncertainty with sponsorships that I have at the moment, with where those are going to go, how those dates are going to pan out. So I like the idea. I love that Constantine's supporting us, but I don't know how far in advance what my schedule is going to be like, or what it's going to be like, or how the companies I'm involved with at the moment, what they're going to need from me within those months. So I like the idea, of course. I mean, I would love to compete in ISL. It was great last year, but I can't say 100% I'm doing this because there's just so many uncertainties right now for everybody. But I mean, I like the idea of, you know, being together with everybody again, racing again. And it'd be pretty cool to have it, you know, in the same spot like that.
For now, Dressel has settled into a routine of keeping fit at home. And in response to requests on how to stay in shape during the pandemic, he posted a video on how to train the abdominals, aptly named the quarantine workout. Meanwhile, Dressel hopes to add another gold medal to the two he won at the Rio Games in 2016. USA Swimming has confirmed team trials for Olympic qualification have been rescheduled and are set to begin on June 13th, 2021. And that is all from me, Sonny. Back over to you.
Thanks, Gwen. That's my VOA colleague, Gwen Uten. And that wraps up the May 20th edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's Newsmaker Interview Program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.